Everyone. Good to see you on this beautiful morning. It's nice to see the sun. I'm going to start with a poem. It's a really short one. And it's called Witness. I want to tell what the forests were like. I will have to speak in a forgotten language. That's the whole poem. And that's by W.S. Merwin. I think it was only just last month that I did a Dharma talk sort of in tribute to the great American poet, Mary Oliver, and I find myself again wanting to pay tribute to another great American poet, W.S. Merwin, who died March 15th of this year at the age of 91. Both Mary Oliver and W.S. Merwin had what I think of as a kind of deep, natural apprehension of the Dharma. Though both made few direct references to Buddhism or Buddhist images, both took the natural world as teacher. But as soon as I say that, Merwin corrects me right away. In an interview, a rare interview where he rarely talked about his connection to Zen and Buddhism, but in 2010 he did an interview with Tricycle magazine. And he said, "I hate even using the word nature because it assumes that we're not part of nature. We're nature, the same way the thrush there is, or the leaves. It's all one. It's all natural. Even our artificial things, our artifice, is in a way natural. I've always felt that way since I was young." He grew up in a religious family. His father was a stern and punitive Presbyterian minister, you know, kind of a harsh faith. And his mother carried the weight of multiple losses. She lost both her parents when she was very young. Later, her brother and her first child, Merwin's older brother, who died shortly after birth. So this was a mother weighed, you know, heavily with her own griefs. So Merwin, as a boy, found refuge from this rather grim environment in his early fascination with language and in the world of trees. This is the poem he wrote called Native Trees. "Neither my father nor my mother knew the names of the trees where I was born. What is that?" I asked, and my father and mother did not hear. They did not look where I pointed. Surfaces of furniture held the attention of their fingers, and across the room they could watch walls they had forgotten, where there were no questions, no voices, and no shade. Were there trees where they were children? Where I had not been, I asked. Were there trees in those places where my father and mother were born? And in that time, did my father and mother see them? And when they said yes, it meant they did not remember. What were they, I asked? What were they? But both my father and mother said they never knew. So he took refuge in learning. He went to Princeton University at the age of 16, quite young, where he studied Romance languages and began to read and write poetry seriously. And after graduation, he moved to Europe, as one does, seeking new ways to be. He married then early and found work as a tutor to the children of the rich and famous in Europe, including the poet Robert Graves. He tutored his son. He moved to London, where he began to work as a translator, and embarked on a second marriage with a woman much older than he, who was came from quite a privileged background, and he commented wryly that she had always wanted to own a poet. So she did for a while, and they moved back to the States for a few years, where he connected to other poets and began to publish. Became connected to poets, and whom I won't list right now. And then he and his wife moved back to Europe, to rural France, and this is a really important, and I think in certain ways, healing time in his life, living close to the land there, and restoring an old decrepit farmhouse. He continued to write and translate. Something I admire about him is that he made his way as a writer through translating, which is a love of mine as well, and outside the academy. You know, he didn't become a poet of the academy, although, you know, tremendously respected. He eventually left that marriage and moved to New York, where he joined with other poets of the time through the 60s, and wrote explicitly in opposition to the Vietnam War. He won his first Pulitzer Prize in 1971. That's the year I came to Canada. You know, that was towards the end of the Vietnam War. And he donated his prize money to peace organizations and took some flack for doing that. The prize money then was $1,000. Mm-hmm. Right? Sounds like, well, is that all to us? So I had to look up and find out that currently it's $15,000 for the Pulitzer Prize winners. He was not a political poet in any polemical way, but he did not hesitate to speak up about human cruelty and injustice, or the harm done to other beings and living systems by human greed and ignorance. He wrote a poem called For a Coming Extinction, way back in the mid-1960s, addressed to the gray whale. I'll just read you the first stanza. Gray whale, now that we are sending you to the end, that great God, tell him that we who follow you invented forgiveness and forgive nothing. Packs a wallop. Yeah, and you know, at the time he wrote that, the gray whale was in worse trouble than it is now. But there are many whales that are still in very serious trouble, as we know. 2 decades later, so we're now in the mid-80s, still a while ago, he wrote this one called To the Insects. Elders, we have been here so short a time, and we pretend that we have invented memory. We have forgotten what it is like to be you, who do not remember us. We remember imagining that what survived us would be like us, and would remember the world as it appears to us. But it will be your eyes that will fill with light. We kill you again and again, and we turn into you, eating the forests. And we turn into you, eating the forests, eating the earth and the water, and dying of them, departing from ourselves, leaving you the morning in its antiquity. As I was looking back over his work, I realized that many of his poems, in hindsight, seem quite prophetic. Here's another one from the mid-80s called, and this, you know, he could have written this now. This is called The Superstition. The cars are disappearing, and we were told they were real. They were only what we thought of them. We were taught that they were beautiful, but we forgot them. We believed they were strong, but they were hauled away. We thought they would take us anywhere, but they had to stop. We thought they were fast, and we have left them far behind. We believed they would save our lives, and we gave our lives for them, thinking they were worth it. We watched them pass with no beginning, no end, glass on all sides. We dreamed of them, and we woke with the headlights flying through us. Haunting. Now, what, 30 years later? So in 1976, Merwin moved to Hawaii to practice Zen with Robert Aiken Roshi, one of the great grandfather of American Zen, one of the earliest. And Merwin lived the rest of his life there. He and his third wife, Paula, with whom he then lived out his life, bought an exhausted pineapple farm. The soil completely exhausted, and devoted the rest of their lives, and still continuing, to restoring it to a lush forest of palms. Merwin was reticent about his Zen practice, but one poem, I think, is perhaps a tribute to Aiken Roshi. It's called Finding a Teacher. In the woods, I came on an old friend fishing, and I asked him a question, and he said, "Wait." Fish were rising in the deep stream, but his line was not stirring. But I waited. It was a question about the sun, about my two eyes, my ears, my mouth, my heart, the earth with its four seasons, my feet, where I was standing, where I was going. It slipped through my hands as though it were water into the river. It flowed under the trees. It sank under hulls far away and was gone without me, and where I stood, night fell. I no longer knew what to ask. I could tell that his line had no hook. I understood that I was to stay and eat with him. I forget what year it was. It was quite a while ago. We had a ceremony to make Norman Fisher the guiding teacher of what was barely Mountain Rain at the time. Mm. So that's like probably something like 20 years ago now. And I read this poem to Norman Fisher about an old friend fishing without a hook. Musō was inspired by a great Japanese Zen master and garden designer, Musō Sōseki. Some of you have been to some of his gardens in Japan. Ryōanji, the very famous one with, is it 7 or 9 stones in sand, and you can never see them all at once. He designed that one and others that still exist. So Merwin translated with a Japanese co-translator, because he doesn't read Japanese or Chinese, a book of Musō Sōseki's poems. And I'll just read you one. A poem on a dry mountain, which is referring to the Zen sand garden, sand and stone garden. A high mountain soars without a grain of dust. A waterfall plunges without a drop of water. Once or twice, on an evening of moonlight in the wind, this man here has been happy, playing the game that suited him. Sneak preview, we're thinking seriously of looking at Musō Sōseki's poetry and prose at the Mountains and Waters retreat this year for those of you who are coming. Merwin also admired Dogen's writing, though I don't think there's any poem that I've encountered that references Dogen. And this is what he said in the Tricycle interview. "I'm just grateful to Dogen for his writing, first of all, and for his example, which is not the way I want to live, but which is his way of looking at the world. And it's very related, you may say, to that kind of awareness, to what I like to keep bringing up in the thing to do about the laureateship." He's referring to accepting the American poet laureate position for the second time in his life, quite late in life, because this was a 2010 interview. He said, "One of the reasons I accepted this position this time was to be able to say something about the relation between the imagination and the environment. I don't think there is a separation. I don't think we have an imagination apart from the environment. And I don't think we have an existence apart from the environment. And if the imagination isn't about our existence, I don't know what it's about." So that's a nice synchronicity, given that our teacher Norman has written a book, just published, about the imagination, the role the imagination plays in living the bodhisattva, walking the bodhisattva path, practicing the paramitas, being able to imagine the lives of other beings, because without that, how can we connect? How can we practice in the world? He goes on to say he appreciates the way Dogen takes a subject and doesn't look for a rational answer to it. He examines it from all sides and plays light on it. He's really writing poetry all the time. So you can see he's really read his Dogen. But he's not willing to talk about Buddhism for long. He says, "Take them away, names like Buddhism. I'm impatient with them. There's something beyond all that, beneath all that, they all share, that they all come from. They are branches from a single root, and that's what one has to pay attention to." And of course, the actual words in the Diamond Sutra that grabbed me, that was his first Buddhist text that that grabbed his attention. Of course, the words were, when the Tathagata, the Buddha, says, "Bodhi, does the Tathagata have a teaching to teach?" And Bodhi says, "No, Lord, the Tathagata has no teaching to teach." "At that point, I got chills down my spine," he says. And the Buddha says, "Because there is no teaching to teach, it is the teaching." I thought, this is it. You know, here we go. I think that goes as far back as shamanism. This is his feeling, reading the Buddhist text for the first time. He really came to feel his connection to indigenous traditions through his close attending to the land of Hawaii. And as a lover of language, he has lamented the loss of indigenous languages and all the knowledge, the earth-based knowledge that they contain, with such specificity. So I'm going to read you another one called Losing a Language. "A breath leaves the sentences and does not come back, yet the old still remember something that they could say, but they know now that such things are no longer believed, and the young have fewer words. Many of the things the words were about no longer exist. The noun for standing in mist by a haunted tree. The verb for I. The children will not repeat the phrases their parents speak. Somebody has persuaded them that it is better to say everything differently so that they can be admired somewhere farther and farther away, where nothing that is here is known. We have little to say to each other. We are wrong and dark in the eyes of the new owners. The radio is incomprehensible. The day is glass. When there is a voice at the door, it is foreign. Everywhere, instead of a name, there is a lie. Nobody has seen it happening. Nobody remembers. This is what the words were made to prophesy. Here are the extinct feathers. Here is the rain we saw. In the Tricycle interview, Merwin said this: I think there's a kind of desperate hope built into poetry now that one really wants, hopelessly, to save the world. One is trying to say everything that can be said for the things that one loves while there's still time. I think that's a social role, don't you? We keep expressing our anger and our love, and we hope, hopelessly perhaps, that it will have some effect. But I certainly have moved beyond the despair or the searing, dumb vision that I felt in my early work. One can't live only in despair and anger without eventually destroying the thing one is angry in defense of. Did you get that? One can't live only in despair and anger without eventually destroying the thing one is angry in defense of. The world is still here, and there are aspects of human life that are not purely destructive, and there is a need to pay attention to the things around us while they are still around us. And you know, in a way, if you don't pay that attention, the anger is just bitterness. You can tell he's living the life of a bodhisattva, even if he never says the word bodhisattva, right? And here's one poem in which I think he kind of expresses his version of the bodhisattva vow. It's called Place. On the last day of the world, I would want to plant a tree. What for? Not the fruit. The tree that bears the fruit is not the one that was planted. I want the tree that stands in the earth for the first time, with the sun already going down and the water touching its roots, in the earth full of the dead and the clouds passing one by one over its leaves. So he did plant trees, more than 2,700 trees representing nearly 500 species of native palms. And in this book called What is a Garden has many beautiful photographs of his garden, his palm forest. I'll leave it out afterwards for you to look through. There, this was once a devastated pineapple farm. And he and Paula have made sure that this work will continue. They've created the Merwin Conservancy, which will continue to take care of this garden. And in a couple of essays in the book, he describes the experience and history of his work there. I'll read you just a little where he says, just being here with the garden, the palm forest, all around us day after day, I think has taught me a great deal. In my own lifetime, I have seen the role of a garden, the very idea of a garden, not merely altered but reversed. Gardens from the beginning, as the etymology of the word suggests, existed as enclaves designed and maintained to keep out the wilderness, to guard what was inside for human use or pleasure. Garden. Yeah. Once it became possible for human beings to destroy environments anywhere on earth, the situation was turned around, and anyone who wanted to protect and save any remaining bit of the natural environment was acting in the role of a gardener. one whose purpose at this point was to keep encroaching human exploitation and disturbance out. The model for this garden has always been the forest itself. Even though I know the word reforestation is generally meaningless and that only a forest knows how to grow a forest. That's certainly what researchers of complex rainforest systems have learned, is that only a forest really knows how to grow a forest. And that once we're, you know, once they're gone, we cannot reproduce that level of complexity. So as I mentioned, his poems often seem prophetic. And there's one I want to read you that is particularly poignant, given that in his last years, Merwin gradually lost his eyesight. And this is called Sight. And this is, again, from the mid-80s. This seems to be my favorite book of his, called The Rain in the Trees. Once a single cell found that it was full of light, and for the first time there was seeing. When I was a bird, I could see where the stars had turned, and I set out on my journey. High in the head of a mountain goat, I could see across a valley, under the shining trees, something moving. Deep in the green sea, I saw two sides of the water and swam between them. I look at you in the first light of the morning for as long as I can. A single cell of vision. So this is his last book, called Garden Time. And his eyesight was so poor, he dictated it entirely to Paula. And this one is called Living with the News. Keep in mind, he's talking about more than one kind of news. Can I get used to it day after day? A little at a time, while the tide keeps coming in faster, the waves get bigger, building on each other, breaking records. This is not the world that I remember. Then comes the day when I open the box that I remember packing with such care. And there is the face that I had known well, in little pieces staring up at me. It is not mentioned on the front pages, but somewhere far back near the real estate. Among the things that happen every day to someone who now happens to be me. And what can I do, and who can tell me? Then there is what the doctor comes to say. Endless patience will never be enough. The only hope is to be the daylight. So I'll read one more. So many of his poems are what would be called elegiac, you know, about loss. And yet also this love of life and commitment to life and nourishing life. This one's called The Wild Geese. It was always for the animals that I grieved most, for the animals I had seen, and for those I had only heard or of or dreamed about, or seen in cages or lying beside the road, for those forgotten and those long remembered, for the lost ones that were never found again. Among people there were words we all knew, even if we did not say them, and although they were always inadequate when we said them, they were there if we wanted them when the time came. With the animals, always there was only presence as long as it was present, and then only absence suddenly and no word for it in all the great written wisdom of China. Where are the animals when they were lost? Where are the ancestors who knew the way without them? All the wise words are bits of sand, twitching on the dunes where the forests once whispered in their echoing ancient tongue, and the animals knew their way among the trees. Only in the old poems does their presence survive, the gibbons call from the mountain gorges. The old words all deepen the great absence. The vastness of all that has been lost is still there when the poet in exile looks up, long ago hearing the voices of wild geese flying above him, flying home. So that resonates with Mary Oliver's Wild Geese poem a little bit, I think. And maybe for many of us, our feeling about our connection to the more than human world. So I will close there with gratitude to W.S. Merwin as one of our, I think we can claim him as one of our Zen ancestors with much gratitude. As he claims the ancestors so beautifully. Yeah, so let's chant together. May I...